Thanks, Tim, for that kind introduction. I've been asked by the organizers, if I can find my notes here, to talk about green jobs and the transition to a green economy. As Tim noted, my involvement with this began in 2007 when Cornell, Global Labor Institute, and World Watch partnered on a project to look at green jobs globally. One of the things we had to do in this year-long study was try to match the data, or like find the data, to match the political debate that was going on. You may remember Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both campaigned on 5 million new green jobs, and everywhere you looked or listened, green jobs were being mentioned as part of the policy proposals at the time. And we spent a lot of time talking about, well, what is a green job? And I could spend all of my 15 minutes going into the definitional wrangles around that. But we sort of came down to it would be a job that reduced energy, water, and materials use, reduced or avoided pollution, or reduced greenhouse gas emissions. There are two other things I'd like to say about what we felt about what constituted a green job. The first was that we thought that a job that was classified green today may not be classified green tomorrow. And so somebody working on a motor vehicle now that does 35 miles to the gallon might be arguably classed as green. But 10 years from now, we would hope that it would no longer be so. So there was that factor. The other factor is that to be classified as green, a job should also be socially as well as environmentally sustainable. And green jobs should really be good jobs. There's plenty of informal recycling going on in the global south where kids and adults go through garbage dumps to find anything of value. By someone's definition, that could be a green job, but few would argue that it was a good job. So these are the sort of the main issues. Now, turning to the main points that surfaced from the study and in my subsequent work with labor unions on the green economy, is that the green economy is growing and green jobs are growing alongside it, especially in renewable energy. And some of that data was presented in earlier presentations. However, this activity is being completely dwarfed by the economic activity that every year generates more emissions, depletes and contaminates our stores of natural capital, and generally takes us inexorably closer to an uninhabitable world. And it's possible, and this is part of the trade union debate, it's possible to grow the number of green jobs, but actually only delay, really, the sort of tipping point of the day of reckoning that we face as a species by, say, maybe a few years or so. So the growth in green jobs needs to be seen in the context of what's going on in the overall economy. Now, regarding what needs to be done and the policy discussions, I was impressed by the rigor and quality and passion in which the research was presented today by different contributors. But I would offer this. The climate situation, I believe, is alone serious enough to justify the boldest possible public interventions into economic life. These interventions can serve three important goals at the same time. Firstly, they can begin to seriously address the climate and environmental crisis. Pretty much everybody in this room knows that emissions are rising globally. They're rising in all parts of the world, not just the global south, although the emissions rates are growing faster there than they are in the global north. They're continuing to rise inexorably upward. So to deal with that, the IPCC has said that to reach the sort of the climate goals that the science says is required, we need a 25 to 40% reduction by 2020 on 1990 levels for the developed world. And by 2050, globally, it'll have to be a 50 to 75% reduction. Now, if we're going to take the science seriously, and that science in some quarters is conservative science, if we're going to take it seriously, then we have to have the kind of policy actions that meets the challenge head on and not seeks to be satisfied with incremental measures. So the second thing such public intervention could do is to restore democratic input and accountability over major economic decisions and investment decisions, and at the same time, they can create very significant numbers of good quality jobs. Now, the political reality is such that public intervention, nationalization, social ownership and control is not part of the policy discourse in most countries. That's the reality. But the challenge, I think, then, if it's not that, then what is it? Because I think the data points us only in one direction at this present time. Now, I would call what's required in terms of the architecture a New Deal approach is needed. I started talking about this 4 years ago, and I wasn't the one who got New Deal into the discourse. I can take no credit for that. But I would say that the New Deal approach must be at least as ambitious as the New Deal of the FDR in the 1930s in the United States, that anything less than that will not get us to where we need to be. Now, I would say that the New Deal approach would have three priorities. These are largely formulated in the U.S. context. I don't think they differ too much across the developed world, but you'll be the judge of that. First of all, there needs to be, I believe, public ownership of power generation and fossil fuel deposits as a first move. This can allow for a speedy transition, and speedy in these terms are probably 20 to 30 years, from fossil-based power generation to renewable alternatives. The emissions from power generated through fossil sources are well known, 30 to 40% globally, and to deal with that problem, we need to have control over the energy system and the fossil fuel deposits. The fossil fuel deposits need to be phased out, and private markets will not do that. The six top oil companies made $1 trillion in profits in the last 5 years, and coal and gas is already booming. Meanwhile, renewable energy is simply not growing fast enough. So the second priority, I think, of a New Deal approach should be government-administered climate jobs programs aimed at radical energy conservation in commercial and residential buildings. This climate jobs program should be modeled on the highly successful direct hire New Deal programs, the Public Works Administration and the Civic Works Administration in the U.S. In the U.S., 40% of emissions are generated from buildings, and this could be more than halved by 2030. It could be self-financing because there will be savings in energy costs. It could be jobs-driven, which means the benefits go to the base of the economy very quickly, and there are many other social co-benefits that would come with such an approach. The third priority, though, I think, is to engage in what I call social nationalization of the major banks and financial institutions. This is a point I won't be able to develop today. This, I believe, though, is crucial to a climate protection agenda. These banks are presently awash with public money, and they no longer lend to the long-term capital-intensive projects that would be needed to transition to a green economy and create jobs. They no longer lend that much to small businesses either. And which is preventing employment coming down. In dollar terms, the bailout of the banks far exceeded the money needed to buy them out completely. I'm not alone in this view. Joe Stiglitz, many major financial observers said the present banking system has to be restructured and broken up, and that a nationalization has already taken place in the form of a public bailout. Now we need to turn those banks into service for social and environmental needs. Bringing the banks into public ownership will restore the sanity to the banking function and release capital for social and environmental protection. Other interventions could also yield positive environmental employment-related dividends in transport infrastructure, development of sustainable agriculture and food processing and retail systems, forestry management, recycling and waste disposal systems, but we don't have time to deal with those here. Now, for those who are concerned that the private sector will be squeezed out and government bureaucracies will reign, I urge you to consider the following. First, the 1930s New Deal, the development of the interstate highway system, rural electrification, and the fight against soil depletion led by the Tennessee Valley Authority. A section of the private sector went along with the program and prospered. That can happen again. The government will also be in a position to use its powers of procurement to insist on and enforce positive conditionalities to ensure jobs created are good jobs and the work performed complies with clear environmental standards and engages communities in decision making. A mass retrofit and energy conservation program would also drive local green supply chains in the skills and hardware needed to do the job. The government will create the demand and responsible private companies will provide a large portion of the goods and services. Secondly, More than 50% of green R&D is already financed by governments now. Globally, a good portion of the trillions of dedicated by governments around the world to re-stimulate the economy after the 2008 crash were dedicated to green investments. This came from public funds, not from private investors. These funds did mobilize private capital, but only after the fact. So the point is this: to the extent that there is a transition to a green economy beginning to take place, public funds are already playing a big role, especially at the R&D end, but also as an enabler of green economic activity. Now, just a quick glance at the green jobs data. I have 5 minutes left. Thank you for that. The UNEP Green Jobs Report looked at all sectors and she'd seen where the jobs were occurring. In most sectors, the growth of green jobs were being outstripped by the growth in non-green jobs. So just looking at green job growth is profoundly misleading. For every new organic farmer, there are probably 10 small farmers in the global south using sustainable methods who are being driven out of food production by industrial agriculture, which is a major source of poor health and greenhouse gas emissions. For every worker employed producing fuel-efficient vehicles, there are dozens working producing dirty vehicles. In urban public transport, some 1.3 million people work on those transit systems in the European Union and the United States alone. But there are 3 million truck drivers in the United States and 1.3 million in the EU 27 countries. For every worker installing solar panels or working on weatherization, many more workers are engaged in constructing a built environment that continues to go in the direction of more sprawl, big box retail, and new road build. Green employment has gained an important foothold in the developed world, but with the major exception of China and Brazil, it is still quite exceptional in the developing countries. Yet these are the countries that account for some 80% of the world's workforce. Finally, green jobs are expanding, but so is the global labor market by roughly $40 million workers a year. Now, I'll just spend a few final comments on the energy system, because a lot was pointed out about how the energy system is being changed by the advance of renewables, and maybe we don't need the kind of interventions I'm proposing. Presently, the number of workers in renewable energy around the world is estimated to be 2.3 million workers. The wind power industry employs 300,000, solar PV 170,000, and solar thermal 600,000. Greening energy also makes a lot of other jobs green, so it's crucially important that energy, renewable energy, advance from an employment as well as an environmental perspective. In China, the commitment to scale up renewable energy has created 1.1 million jobs by the end of 2008. By 2020, the Chinese renewable energy standard will add 1 million new jobs. But let's look at the other side, the darker side of the equation. Annual global investment in renewable energy rose almost sixfold in 12 years to 2007. But this increase merely keeps pace with the expanding demand for energy, and it's fossil fuels that are meeting the lion's share of this growing demand. In 2008, fossil fuels accounted for 78% of final energy consumption. Will this change? The total percentage of global energy demand projected to be met by renewables in 2020 is only 11%, up from 9% last year, according to the EIA. So this deployment of renewables as a percentage of total energy production and consumption is inadequate. The climate emergency alone demands much higher investment, both in the U.S. and globally. The IEA's 2000 World Energy Outlook estimated $550 billion needs to be invested in renewable energy and energy efficiency each year from 2009 to 2030 to reduce CO2 levels to where they need to be. Now, if we look, though, at the investment in fossil, we can see some pretty worrying figures. In 2008, ExxonMobil announced plans to commit $120 billion on capital exploration projects by 2012. In 2009, Shell announced it would no longer invest in wind and solar. Linda Cook, Shell's executive director of gas and power, said, "We are businesslike men and women. If there were renewables which made money, we would put money into it. Wind and solar are interesting, but we may continue to struggle with other investment opportunities in the portfolio, even with big studies in many markets. We do not expect material investment in wind and solar going forward. This is in the context of an immense crisis facing human civilization. The business calculus of many of the leading fossil companies is unchanged despite that reality. I don't have time to go into the boom in shale gas, where the emissions profile of that is reported to be at least as bad as coal, according to a recent Cornell study. I don't also have time, my time is up, to talk about how a climate jobs program could, through a direct hire system, embark on a radical energy conservation program across the developed world. That would create many millions of jobs that would be saved financing. I would refer you, though, to a study at Rutgers University, Philip Harvey produced on on New Deal programs and how successful they were. It doesn't mention climate change or environmental protection, but the same logic would apply, that climate jobs, particularly in energy conservation, could be very, very significant. So my conclusions, if I may have one more quick minute, is that I assume that we all want to create good green jobs that contribute to social justice and equity. And I assume that we all want to see action to reduce emissions according to science-based targets and timetables. And I assume that you appreciate that the situation demands solutions of the size, scale, and ambition that are commensurate to the challenges we face. I don't expect everyone here to agree with my proposals for public interventions and democratic ownership of banks and power generation, but I would ask you then to address the incapacity of private markets to even begin to solve the problem, or to apprehend those companies who continue every minute of the day to make an already serious situation far, far worse. I thank you for your time and attention.